with VOA News via remote.
I'm Laurel Bowman.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson on Saturday announced a stay-at-home order for London and Southeast England to slow a new coronavirus strain that is significantly more infectious. Johnson said in a televised briefing that the new strain of the virus does appear to be passed on significantly more easily. He ordered these new restrictions for London and southeastern England from Sunday, saying that under the new Tier 4 rules, residents in those areas must stay at home at least until December 30th. Beijing on Saturday accused the United States of bullying after Washington announced export controls on dozens of Chinese firms over alleged ties to China's military. The announcement in the final weeks of U.S. President Donald Trump's term comes after relations between Washington and Beijing soured under his administration, which saw the U.S. start a trade war with China and expand its list of sanctioned entities to a few hundred Chinese companies and subsidiaries. China's Commerce Ministry said Saturday it firmly opposes the move and vowed to take necessary measures to safeguard Chinese companies' rights. The U.S. Commerce Secretary on Friday said the designations, which restrict U.S. companies' abilities to do business with these firms, are over an array of charges, including human rights abuses and the activities of the Chinese military, particularly in the South China Sea. Meanwhile, China's military tailed a U.S. warship as it passed through the sensitive Taiwan Strait on Saturday, the Chinese military said, denouncing such missions as sending flirtatious glances to supporters of Taiwan independence. China, which claims democratically run Taiwan as its own territory, has been angered by stepped-up U.S. support for the island. This is VOA News. Leaders of the three main armed rebel groups occupying large areas of the Central African Republic announced a coalition Saturday, while the government accused former President Francois Bozize of an attempted coup ahead of next week's elections. The rebels announcement could further fuel tensions already on the rise in the troubled country before the presidential and legislative vote on December 27th. Where the opposition fears massive electoral fraud could occur. UN peacekeepers, meanwhile, deployed in response to fresh attacks as UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres appealed for calm and for all sides to work together to ensure credible elections there. The armed groups decided to combine all movements into a single entity called the Coalition of Patriots for Change, or CPC, and under a unified command, the rebels wrote in a statement, the CPC invited all other armed groups to join. Meanwhile, the government said Saturday that ex-President Bozize was intending to march on the capital with his men. A government spokesman said this is clearly an attempted coup d'etat that the government denounces during this electoral period. Bozize, who recently returned after years in exile, has been barred from running in the election by the country's top court, as he has been sought in an international arrest warrant filed by the CAR on charges including murder, arbitrary arrest, and torture. Bozize, who came to power in a coup in 2003 before being overthrown in 2013, did say on Tuesday that he accepted the court's decision. NATO said Saturday it was checking its computer systems after a massive cyber attack on U.S. government agencies and others that Washington blamed on Moscow. A top official told AFP that at this time, no evidence of compromise has been found on any NATO networks, but that experts would continue to assess the situation. Microsoft said Thursday its antivirus software detected intrusions in dozens of network systems, with the largest being in the U.S. Microsoft President Brad Smith in a blog post said the hack was the most concerning of several nation-state attacks seen this year. He added that outside the U.S., networks in seven other countries were affected in Belgium, Britain, Canada, Israel, Mexico, Spain, and the United Arab Emirates. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on Friday said, "We can say pretty clearly that it was the Russians that engaged in this activity. Russia denied involvement." And EU and UK negotiators press on with talks in Brussels, but with no sign of them breaking an impasse over post-Brexit fishing rights in time to save a deal.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in the Ghanaian capital, Accra.
Many people find the ruling quite unfair. They find it disrespectful, and several people are in admiration for my courage, for my will to just press on.
A Ugandan human rights activist instructs defense lawyers to appeal a court's compensation order over police brutality.
By scripture, I can tell you on authority, Ghana is just a drop in the ocean when it comes to God's plan for the world. So definitely, if God has something to say to Ghana, he will definitely say it in a way that when you hear it, your heart will be at peace, not confused.
Does religion influence Ghanaian politics, since about 70% of the citizens say they are Christians?
You get this idea that the country is in a free fall. He has to stop this. If he's going to continue to stay as president, he cannot continue to stay as president and wait out his 2 years when the country is becoming increasingly under the influence of criminals. This is our position.
And the Northern Elders Forum says Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari appears unable to resolve the growing insecurity situation the country faces. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Ugandan human rights defender says she is not entirely pleased with a court ruling which awarded her about $9,500. Nana Annette Namata, also known as Mwafrika Mbarikiwa, says her focus is not on the funds the court ordered to be paid to her, but to seek justice. Her remarks come after a court ruled that she be compensated for what the local media describes as the police brutality she suffered. The human rights defender had filed a case against police officers whom she accused of using excessive force against her as she protested. Ms. Namata confirmed local media reports that she lost her uterus due to what she says was the brutal force the police used to stop her protest. She says the court's compensation order failed to incorporate punishment for the police officers who were responsible for her ordeal. But some Ugandans say she should take the money and go her way. An assertion Namata rejected. She tells me that she has instructed her lawyers to appeal the court's ruling.
The High Court ruling by Judge Musa Sekana, for me, it got me, you know, just laughing. It's laughable. $35 million. This is about $8,000. I lost my uterus, suffered mental anguish. My family suffered. My friends suffered. No, I'm going to court of appeal. I need the errant police officers punished, or they gotta pay heavily.
Nana, a lot of Ugandans are saying, why don't you take the money and go? Why are you partially rejecting the court's ruling of 35 million Ugandan shillings awarded to you?
A human rights defender, and this was never about the money. I didn't set out to go and address issues of human rights violations to get beaten and paid and get paid. I didn't go to get tortured for a fee. I am not exchanging my cause for nothing. That's nothing. That doesn't even cover my medical bills. No. I want justice that works for me and Ugandans. Justice that brings an end to police brutality.
So now that you have partially rejected the ruling, what are you going to do next? Have you advised your lawyers about your next steps forward about this case?
Yes, Peter. I told you that, yes, I have already instructed my lawyers to file an appeal to the Court of Appeal, so I further press my case. Yes, we shall press for a substantial award of damages. You know, that should go a long way to bring government and its security agencies to order. And yes, this case, I feel, should set precedent by reminding law enforcement officers that they can't always behave the way they want and get away with it. Yes, we are on it.
But do you think the government will agree to any ruling that punishes some of these, what you described as recalcitrant or erring police officers who you said brutalized you?
Oh, Peter, maybe they will, maybe they won't. What I know, I have a case that won't go away until justice is served. Well, I don't think so, because much to this date, or the time when the ruling was passed, we are still having police brutality ongoing. Yesterday, the city was covered in tear gas and shooting at people. The Political Times, politicians are campaigning, and every day what we witness is police brutality. Maybe they won't punish their officers. If they don't punish their officers, then government can meet the cost of failing to punish and bringing to order their own.
Anna, what has been the reaction of some of your friends that you've spoken with, that you've interacted with, who have supported you throughout your court case against some of these police officers?
Reaction from associates, friends, family, and fellow activists, not very different from mine. Many people find the ruling quite unfair. They find it disrespectful, and several people are in admiration for my courage, for my will to just press on.
Nana Annette Namata, also known as Mwafrika Mbarikiwa, is a Ugandan human rights defender. She spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. The Electoral Commission of Ghana has officially gazetted the electoral victory of incumbent President Nana Addo-Dankwa Akufo-Addo. He defeated main opposition leader and former President John Dramani Mahama. Ahead of the elections, Ghanaians were inundated with predictions about which of the two candidates would win. Analysts often speak about the impact religion has on politics, given that about 70% of the population say they are Christians. To learn more about the impact religion has on Ghanaian election campaigns and politics in general, I caught up with Apostle Abraham Lamte, a prominent cleric in Ghana.
I want us to look at the impact of religion, in our context, the Christian religion, on Ghana's politics. From your perspective, what is the impact that you have seen so far? Because the country has a population approximately 70% who say they are Christians.
You know, this question is quite kind of deeper than it sounds. I'm saying deeper because then you would have to look at the positivities and the negativities and then the purpose of the impact. But if I want to be very true with you, I can say that the impact is quite minute. Positively is minute, because we lack... You see a lot in politics claiming to be Christians. So if they are Christians, they must belong to a church. And if they belong to a church, they must have a pastor. And if they have a pastor, then they must have some spiritual guidance. But then when you hear them speak on air, when you see what they do, you end up asking, are they separating God from politics? That is where the problem is.
Let me take you back. Since I have been in this country to cover the elections, I have seen some of these politicians campaigning, literally, being given the chance to speak to the congregation, speak to the parishioners, in some instances, even preach. Are you therefore saying that the impact and their ability to try to convince the parishioners to vote for them is infinitesimal or small?
We give honor to whom honor is due. And as citizens, we must go by what the Constitution says. So if an MP comes into the church, the fear of God should be the first thing he or she must exhibit. Respect for God should be the second. And true to God should be the third. So when you are giving the platform or the podium or the pulpit to talk to the congregation, exhibit that quality. these three things I have mentioned. When you are through and you step out there, they will be monitoring you. The church members will be following you. Well, I have had some in my church, not one, not two, not three, but I'm so straightforward that when you are through and you sit, that is when I will also talk to you.
Ahead of the elections, there were a lot of these men of God, as they are called, prophesying. Some say one party is going to win, and another said that party is going to win. This presidential candidate will win with this amount. Another says this. How does an ordinary person, perhaps a Christian or non-Christian, decipher which is correct and which is not?
You see, we have something we call exuberance. I don't want to say God didn't talk to Prophet A or he didn't talk to Prophet B because I wasn't there. But by scripture, I can tell you on authority, Ghana is just a drop in the ocean when it comes to God's plan for the world. So definitely, if God has something to say to Ghana, he will definitely say it in a way that when you hear it, your heart will be at peace, not confused.
Apostle Abraham Lamte is the founder and general overseer of Believers House of Worship International. He spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Katsina State authorities welcomed the safe return of 344 Nigerian schoolboys who were abducted by gunmen claiming to be Boko Haram militants and held captive for a week. Authorities said no ransom was paid for the release, which was brokered by an association of cattle herders. For VOA, Timothy Obiezu reports from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
The boys arrived safely Friday at the Katsina State Government House, escorted by security officials to meet with officials. State authorities said no ransom was paid to free the boys from bandits, but noted their release was facilitated by Miyeti Allah Cattle Breeders Association, a loose partisan advocacy group centered on promoting the welfare of pastoralists in Nigeria. Katsina State Governor Aminu Bello Masari, speaking to Deutsche Welle Hausa TV, said the boys will be medically and psychologically evaluated before rejoining their families. He said, "We don't yet know the hospital where they will be checked, but the examination will be in Katsina tomorrow, and then we will be on the way to reunite them with their families." More than 800 boys were at the government science secondary school the night it was attacked by gunmen, but some of them were able to escape to safety. Many are celebrating the release of the boys. Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari described it as a big relief. But the Nigerian Union of Teachers, NUT, which initially threatened strike action if government failed to improve the security situation at the nation's schools, says it might be too early to celebrate the victory if schools can still be attacked. Emmanuel Huendi is NUT's public relations officer.
The union, in our last statement, talked about embarking on a strike. If the safety of our schools is not guaranteed, we'll still hold on government, we'll still put pressure on government to ensure that words are matched with action.
The Nigerian authorities have said they are working with the police and private security firms to secure schools and prevent similar attacks in the future. The Boko Haram militant group claimed responsibility for the abduction of more than 300 schoolboys in Katsina last Friday, perhaps its most audacious kidnapping in 6 years. Families of the boys have expressed joy and excitement about their release and are hoping to be reunited with them soon. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Still in Nigeria, the Northern Elders Forum says the recent abduction of over 300 school children is yet another indication that the government has failed in its core duty to protect life and property. Dr. Hakim Baba Ahmed, spokesperson for the group, says it's clear that the government in Abuja appears to be incapable of addressing escalating insecurity situation in parts of the country. His remark comes after local media reports say the students were kidnapped by Boko Haram militants from a boarding school in northwestern Nigeria have been released. Their freedom was being hailed by officials who say that the Nigerian military has demonstrated that it is capable of dealing with insecurity, including the militants. Meanwhile, President Muhammadu Buhari is urging citizens to be patient as his administration deals with insecurity challenges facing the country. But Dr. Ahmed, spokesperson for the Northern Elders Forum, tells me that the group maintains its stance that the president must resign.
Well, to say the least, this is profoundly shocking. There are no other ways to explain this. We've seen a bad situation. We've seen situations getting bad. But, I mean, this is possibly the worst possible position we can be. In addition to all the security challenges we had, a few weeks ago, the Northern Elders Forum advised the president, in the light of what appeared to be his failure to improve the security of our citizens, we asked him to do the honorable thing, to resign. But even then, none of us envisaged that we could wake up and find a situation where hundreds of school children are abducted, right, literally right under the nose of the president, who was holidaying in the same state, his home state, by bandits, by criminals. Our reaction is so numbing, one really doesn't know what to say. This is what we foresaw when we made the comment about the failure of the president to improve security of citizens. And that's his first responsibility. We don't see what the president is doing as a president and commander-in-chief of the armed forces to the degree that he cannot protect Nigerians. That's our reaction.
Dr. Hakim, some Nigerians are saying that the abduction of these children is yet another indication of the deteriorating security situation in the country. Is that the stance of the Northern Elders Forum? And does your call for him to resign still stand?
Well, obviously, it doesn't need, it's not rocket science for anybody to understand that the security situation in the country is deteriorating by the day, literally by the day, under President Buhari. Our demand that he should resign because he doesn't indicate, there's nothing to suggest that he will change the way he secures the country, he will change the people who he has trusted to secure Nigerians, he will change his tactics, he will change his strategy, he will change his attitude to the welfare of Nigerians. He's getting more and more support. It took us a long time to come up with this conclusion and to go public with the statement that we don't believe the president can improve on his performance in securing Nigerians. And we were alone out there. We got a lot of stick. I have to be honest with you. Many people thought, how can you say this? We reminded them that in 2013, the same President Buhari, when he was then a candidate, had said the same thing to President Jonathan. 2 years before he became president, the same President Buhari, because Boko Haram was running riot all over the north, President Buhari said in public to President Jonathan, resign. You are not capable of running this country. Unfortunately, the same situation, not the same situation, considerably worse situation is going on. But even then, when we said to the president, Mr. President, you are a democratically elected president. One of the only two things you are elected to do is to secure citizens. You have failed to do that. The honorable thing to do is to resign. We got a lot of stick. I mean, we got a lot of people who thought we were doing the right thing. We said the right thing. It took courage in this country. Now more and more people are saying, yeah, we agree with the Northern Elders Forum. There really isn't anything to justify the continued stay of President Buhari as president of the Federal Republic of Nigeria. He should do the horrible thing and resign. Because even after Mazabar Mari, where only God knows how many villagers were slaughtered, literally slaughtered, in Borno State, that was when we made that statement. Hundreds of people have died in the hands of kidnappers and bandits. Literally every single day people die. And now we have Kankara right in Katsina State, right in the state where the president was holidaying. He hasn't been to Katsina. He hasn't been to Kankara. He's sitting there in his home state, holidaying, and hundreds of children are in the hands of criminals. So, more and more Nigerians are lining up and demanding that the president should resign. We hope if he is going to insist that he runs out his 2 years, if he does that, then we can only hope that he finds the will somewhere to improve the way he runs his government, improve his level of response and respect for public opinion, understands that Nigerians are scared, we are running from pillar to post, we are defenseless, literally. And this, you get this idea that the country is in a free fall. He has to stop this. If he's going to continue to stay as president, he cannot continue to stay as president and wait out his 2 years when the country is becoming increasingly under the influence of criminals. This is our position.
Dr. Hakim Baba Ahmed is the spokesperson for the Northern Elders Forum. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Twenty has been especially tough for Zimbabwe, hitting the landlocked nation with a triple whammy of growing political tensions and repression, a shattered economy, further hamstrung by international sanctions, and a global pandemic. But for more than a decade, Zimbabwe's southern neighbor, the anchor of democracy on the continent, has been accused of doing too little, provoking analysts to call for South Africa to step up. VOA's Anita Power reports from Johannesburg on a new report that examines what's at stake.
For a year, Joy Mabange, a political analyst and also country director of ActionAid Zimbabwe, has watched a pandemic take his country from dire to disastrous. When the pandemic hit, he said, this is what it found.
We have had a political crisis in the country. We have had an economic crisis. We have had a humanitarian crisis in terms of the food insecurity situation here in Zimbabwe. And of course, you would also appreciate that last year, certain parts of the country were also hit by cyclone, the latest being Cyclone Idai. So when COVID-19 came through, it came through upon an overburdened country, upon an overburdened citizen. This is a citizenry that has suffered a lot in terms of rights abuses. This is a citizen that has suffered a lot in terms of just lack of access to basics.
In August, seven countries, the U.S., Germany, Poland, Britain, Canada, Norway, and the Netherlands, urged President Emmerson Mnangagwa to keep his 2018 inauguration pledge to respect human rights, amid reports that he was using the pandemic as a cover to restrict freedoms. In a joint statement, they urged him to desist, to recognize citizens' universal rights and freedoms, and to investigate and prosecute all violations of human rights. A spokesman for Zimbabwe's ruling party memorably called their statement a piece of rubbish. Notably missing from that list was the one country that has, arguably, the greatest pull over Zimbabwe, neighboring South Africa. In October, South Africa joined other countries in Southern Africa in calling for the removal of crippling Western sanctions on Zimbabwe. Analyst Piers Pigou of the International Crisis Group says South Africa seems to have recently shifted away from its longstanding policy of quiet diplomacy and into something more open and critical. He detailed that relationship in a new report and spoke to VOA about it.
There have been questions asked about the efficacy of that approach, the cost-benefit of that approach. And in the context of a set of very serious challenges in Zimbabwe following the November 2017 coup d'etat that brought Mr. Mnangagwa into the presidency, the hopes of an effective reform, re-engagement and recovery process have not been realized. So it was within that context of a set of promises, many of which remain on the table around reforms, that South Africa has engaged Zimbabwe with a more publicly critical narrative.
So what can South Africa do to help its neighbor more publicly and in a way that brings about actual reform? Pigou emphasized that regional cooperation within Africa and through the African Union is key.
President Ramaphosa could use his position as AU chair to shine some light on this issue. He's there for another month or so as AU, so we think that there's an opportunity for him to shine a light on the issues. This is not about imposing a solution or external solutions or agendas on Zimbabwe. This is rather about assisting to help have a more even playing field in which Zimbabweans can resolve their own problems.
Because, as analysts like to point out, Zimbabwe has a lot going for it. The country has a high literacy rate, strong education system, and good arable land. three ingredients that usually give a nation a chance at making its own success. With, they add, a little help from its friends. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of the Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in the Ghanaian capital, Accra. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in marking International Migrants Day, the United Nations reports 3,174 migrants have died this year while seeking safety from persecution and violence or in hopes of bettering their impoverished lives. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The International Organization for Migration says the number of recorded migrant deaths is likely to be highly underestimated. It says tens of thousands of people embark on dangerous journeys across deserts, jungles, and seas. Many thousands do not survive, but their deaths, it says, are not recorded. The IOM says the overall number of global migrant deaths recorded this year is lower than in previous years. However, it notes fatalities have increased significantly on some of the migratory routes. For example, IOM spokesman Paul Dillon says at least 593 deaths have been documented in 2020 en route to Spain's Canary Islands, compared to 45 fatalities in 2018.
An increase in migrants' deaths was also recorded in South America compared to previous years, with at least 104 lives lost, most of them Venezuelan migrants, compared to fewer than 40 in all previous years. This includes at least 23 people who drowned off the coast of Venezuela last weekend. Some 381 men, women, and children also lost their lives on the U.S.-Mexican border.
This year, migration within and en route to Europe claimed the largest number of lives, more than 1,700. Dillon says a significant number of the deaths were among migrants from sub-Saharan Africa. He says migrants are not just statistics. He says they are people who make significant contributions to their countries of migration, especially in this time of coronavirus.
What we see every day are the images of doctors and nurses and support staff in healthcare facilities and old age homes, many of whom are migrant workers contributing to the response to the COVID-19 pandemic, saving lives, putting in the long, arduous hours on behalf of those who are stricken with the virus.
Dillon says migrants should be welcomed and appreciated for the services and beneficial roles they perform in their adopted societies instead of being vilified and subjected to discrimination. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
As a new year begins and a new American presidential administration prepares to take office, relations between the U.S. and Africa have never been more complex or potentially more promising. For the first of our two-part look at where things stand and what to expect with respect to American foreign policy toward the continent in terms of aid, security, and other matters, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with John Campbell, the Ralph Bunche Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Mr. Campbell, who was U.S. Ambassador to Nigeria between 2004 and 2007, began by stressing the continuity of relations between the United States and Africa over the past two decades, despite President Trump's public pronouncement of substantial change.
The often fierce rhetoric from the president about making significant cuts in various programs that benefit Africa. Virtually none of them happen, largely because of bipartisan congressional opposition.
Which programs do you have in mind?
For example, Power Africa, an initiative of the Obama administration designed to increase the production of electricity in Africa, that has continued. The Young African Leadership Initiative, also an Obama program, designed to groom young people for leadership positions in Africa, that has continued. And PEPFAR, the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief, a Bush initiative has continued, and then President Trump's signature initiative with respect to Africa was designed to make American investment in Africa easier. That is just being rolled out now.
The truth is that for many Americans, Africa seems incredibly far off. In simple terms, can you explain why Americans should care about American policy toward Africa at all?
Well, let's start with demography. There are a great many Africans, and there are going to be a great many more of them in the relatively near future. Let's take a specific example. Nigeria at present has 205 million people. By mid-century, 30 years from now, it is anticipated that the population will exceed that of the United States and that it will be, in fact, the third largest country in the world by population. That should provide new markets and opportunities for investment and for general increase in economic links. Then let's move on to security, particularly in the Sahel and in West Africa. Jihadi groups are active, seeking to overthrow governments that are friendly to us. They're deeply hostile to the United States, and while they do not at present pose a threat to American security, they certainly pose a threat to American interests, and they may pose a threat to American security in the future.
And then there is the general movement toward democracy in Africa,
which Americans, almost all Americans, support and favor. Some African countries very much have a democratic trajectory that is positive. You put all that together, and we should be paying a great deal more attention to Africa than we have in the past, not as a matter of charity or assistance or aid, but simply because of our own interests.
What about American diplomacy toward Africa in the incoming Biden administration?
I find it interesting that President-elect Biden's choice for American ambassador to the UN, probably our most important diplomatic position, that he has tapped Linda Thomas Greenfield, a career diplomat who specialized in Africa and was ambassador to Liberia.
Of course, aid is a big part of America's policy toward the continent.
But I would caution here, the American economy is challenged. The incoming administration does not have as much money as I suspect many Africans assume it will have. I think in the shorter term, where the difference will be quite clear is in rhetoric and in atmosphere. There will certainly be an end to disparaging comments about Africa that have come out of the White House. I would expect that President Biden will visit Africa and that he will host African heads of state. These are matters of symbols, but symbols are extremely important.
John Campbell is the Ralph Bunche Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and a former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Another 6 o'clock is here. Wake up and meet the morning, dear. Brand new day is a brand new slate. Like Barack say, yes, I can. Don't let the worries of yesterday hold you down on this lovely day. Well, look up in the mirror and say, yes, I can. Open your face, open your face. Not turn away. Dani Mugwala Kabo, Magana Marekena Blow. Not turn away. Open your face, open your face. Magana Marekena Blow. Dani Mugwala Kabo. won't look up in the mirror and say, yes, I can. Goodbye, my friend.
Keep on in one.
believe it. Super sexy for me. Makes me just wanna brace it. Just wanna brace. Yeah, the way you shake it. Like you really do the shake up for me. Gary, baby, be mine. Can't make you not try. See how she just fine. Oh, she be hot, she be hot, she be hot like that. She give me the sign. Can't make you not try. For me, she didn't want. Oh, so hot, she be hot like that. Da di da di da di da di da. While I eat, my heart beats for her body.
But it's big intro though. The only time you see us fight is with a pillow though. I lie, I'll be searching for your love to my pillow low. Baby, make you bend up for me. For down seven. Kapani kuta me de kapeche. It's so wanna Jimmy Rabete. And then you su and Jimmy Boka keke. Shorty, I can take you there. Phone soon I'm my friend. Promise no go keep you chair. Chairman now open and make a pen and make a bird. Shorty, I can take you there. Phone soon I'm my friend. But you find I can he married your bonelle and I want it, they can try and look stupid, my baby.
Daddy, 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 daddy.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, Managing Editor Shaka Sally, Reporter Douglas Impuga, and Producer Said Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, on a dead tree, there are no monkeys. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Good evening, Africa.